Welcome to Face to Face. I'm Rhonda Pence in New York City. Joining me today is Julian Assange. Co-founder of WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is a website designed to be a safe haven for whistleblowers around the world, where documents, leaked documents, are published in their entirety so viewers can read them and make their own determination. Most recently, WikiLeaks released a 2007 video from New Baghdad, where U.S. Apache helicopter pilots were gunning down civilians. Thank you so much for joining me, Julian. People are talking about this video. They're blogging about this video. They're Twittering about this video. For viewers who have not yet seen this video, can you describe it for us?
Yeah, so the video in full is 38 minutes long. It is taken from the gunsight of the lead Apache helicopter called Crazy Horse. It shows three events. Firstly, an attack on a gathering of around 20 relaxed-looking people, two of which may have had weapons, but it was fairly normal for that to be happening in Baghdad at that time. In that group are two Reuters journalists from Baghdad, a photographer, Namir, and his driver and assistant, Saeed. Namir is walking towards the corner with his camera strapped over his shoulder, and the Apache asks and gets permission to engage or open fire to shoot with its 30mm cannon shells that are this big, the entire group. By that stage, there are about nine people together, including Namir and Saeed, and they are all mowed down, all killed, with the exception of Saeed, who is wounded. Saeed crawls along, and this is the second event, crawling on the ground in the gutter. You can see him by his white shirt, and the gunners and the pilots in the Apache are then saying, "Come on, buddy, pick up a weapon. All we need you to do is pick up a weapon," because they know that under the rules of engagement, there's any weapons that are seen nearby him or he tries to pick one up, then they can kill him. Of course, there are no weapons there. In fact, they can't see any weapons there. Everyone else is dead. This is not a combat situation.
Now, I've seen this video, of course. I attended the press conference you held in Washington, D.C., and it is as if you are inside the Apache helicopter, almost watching people play a video game with the words you describe, light them up, shoot them up. Except, of course, these are real people who are being shot down. Why do you want the world to see this video?
We're particularly concerned with this video, not because of it's another war video, but because of the cover-up that was involved. This is also a video that has killed journalists who can't have been insurgents. I mean, for any other sort of victim, they may, except a child, there is always an allegation, well, maybe they were really insurgents.
But there was shooting in New Baghdad. About 20 to 25 minutes before the Apache helicopters arrived, there was open gunfire. So the pilots apparently could have thought insurgents were there. But as you said, the Reuters journalists were walking around relaxed. They saw the Apache helicopters, and they were not afraid. Why do you think there was so much targeting going on and so much shooting for so long?
Well, it was 20, according to classified U.S. military records. There was shooting, small arms fire, somewhere in New Baghdad, not in the street, 28 minutes before the Apaches circled around and saw this group. So there, also in that classified documentation, it says that they were not able to identify who was doing the shooting. So there cannot be any allegation that they know that this group had anything to do with the shooting that was happening 28 minutes beforehand. So it appears that these were just very bloodthirsty pilots. But you hear in their language, this seems to be another day at the office. The pilots are fairly relaxed during this whole episode, and just get excited and enthusiastic when they're actually killing people. So it seems to be a type of debasement of war. You know, you expect people to become debased by war, their characters to be corrupted by engaging in war. But because of the removed nature of the Apache, where they can't hear anyone on the ground, they're a long way up, they're totally removed, and it looks like a video game with a cross when you press the button.
It sort of looks like a video game.
That over time, these pilots started thinking it really was a video game, and they got pleasure by getting a high score, and was also a source of pride to them. So I mean, they brag to the ground forces, "Hey, we shot 12 to 15. You'll go there, you'll find 12 to 15 bodies." Source of pride. And they congratulate each other, you know, saying, "Nice shoot," and they joke about the dead bodies. A little bit of gallows humor. It's sort of you expect this in war, this black humor. But so I'm not so concerned about the black humor. But it's the enthusiasm for the killing that seems to me to be the problem. And they're looking for any excuse to kill. They know the rules. I mean, they do not try and shoot before saying that there are weapons or looking for weapons. They do not shoot Saeed when he is crawling on the curb, when he has no weapon. When the van arrives, it seems like they know something about the rules, that if insurgents are escaping, they can shoot. And later on with the house, they say, "Hey, we have seen six armed men go in there. Hey, we can now put a missile in it." So they know these rules fairly well. They always ask their commanding officer for permission to attack in the three major events. And later on, after complaints by Reuters about the deaths of their journalists, there was a review. So there was internal military investigation as to whether any laws were broken, whether rules of engagement were broken. And the review found no rules were broken in this event, that this was perfectly acceptable. And there has been no disciplining of those troops, no imprisonment, as far as we know, no demotions of those individuals. So either there's a problem with that review, a problem with the internal judicial system in the United States military, the internal mechanisms of accountability, or those really were the rules and everyone did follow the rules, and the review panel was also acting in the right way when it said that everyone followed the rules. Then there's a problem with the rules.
Now the Pentagon says it can't find this video. Did you get this video from the US military?
Well, we never reveal where we get material from precisely, but obviously this passed through the hands of military officers or enlisted personnel on its way to us. When we first got this, we got it with a brief textual description. We didn't really even know what we had. We originally thought this was a video about Afghanistan, and it was only once we decrypted it, which took a volunteer effort, many people donating their computers to help go through all the different passwords and find one to decrypt it. It was only then that we started to see what was going on, and started researching this more and more and more. And the more we looked, the worse it became.
WikiLeaks has another video coming out, similar to this one, but shot in Afghanistan?
Yes, we have a number of additional videos, including one about Afghanistan that we are working on, analyzing and assessing it. And we hope to send someone to Afghanistan as well, like we did with this video that was about Baghdad, because getting that backstory is really important.
So this is your assessment, that this is modern warfare going on?
This is the first glimpse we've had of what modern warfare is really like. I mean, at each stage in our history, modern has meant something different. But the warfare of the type that's been happening in the past 5 years, this advanced high-tech warfare with very powerful zoom lenses, with powerful targeting systems that make it more like a video game. And so now we can kind of understand, when we hear 33 civilian casualties in Afghanistan or some other place in the world, something happening in Israel where this high-tech weaponry is used, I don't mean to pick on this US or in particular, but that's the country that has the most high-tech weaponry. When we hear people killed in an airstrike, this is what it's like. High-tech zoom lenses, crosshairs, and pressing a button. And that's a problem because it means this video game mentality must be creeping in to all these pilots and gunners.
So what do you want to happen? Do you want an investigation into these pilots? Who do you want to see this video? What are you hoping to accomplish?
We want the incident reopened. The two investigative reports that were done into this were not released by the Pentagon until we released the video. So one of them was released sort of in response on Monday and another one on Tuesday. Both of those investigation reports are clearly biased. I mean, they're not only very short. Remember, a lot of people died, including two Reuters journalists. They're not only short, it sounds like they've been written by a defense lawyer. So I don't think there's any, I don't think it can be argued that these were mutual, objective, comprehensive investigations whatsoever. And there's also key facts that are wrong.
You've had Sarah Palin's hacked emails published on WikiLeaks, Wesley Snipes' tax returns. That's certainly not in the same category as NATO's plans on the Afghan war. But why Wesley Snipes' tax returns?
So this, and I'm glad you raised that, because it's quite irritating that people are speaking about that. Wesley Snipes' tax returns were there, not because it's Wesley Snipes, but because there was a scheme to evade tax. This is a rich person who has a particular scheme, you know, some offshore scheme to evade tax. That's why that was interesting from our perspective. Similarly with Sarah Palin, well, she is a political figure who could be the next president. So actually almost everything to do with her is politically interesting. But in this particular case, she was using not her government email account, but a Yahoo email account in order to evade the Freedom of Information Act. And in fact, there was an ongoing lawsuit in Alaska to try and get those emails. So that's a quite interesting case. But nonetheless, we make a promise to our sources that if something is hidden from the public and is not self-authored, and it's of diplomatic, political, ethical, or historical interest, we guarantee to release it. Give it to us, we'll protect you, and we guarantee to release it. So Sarah Palin's emails are of political interest. The evasion from the Freedom of Information Act is of ethical interest. And anything involving the US election at that level is also of historical interest. So we release it.
So you are an Australian award-winning journalist. You're a co-founder of WikiLeaks, and you're sitting on a 9-member board. Who else is part of WikiLeaks?
Well, so, it may surprise some people, but we only have five full-time staff due to funding constraints. But we do have 800 part-timers. So 800 people.
Who are they?
They're from all over the world. They're former Transparency Head International people. They are journalists. They are corruption investigators. They are former intelligence.
Did they contact you? Did you come together through paths crossing?
They're people who have volunteered. I mean, we have many, many lawyers. If you go to WikiLeaks, you'll see at the moment we are in a fundraising volunteer drive. And so if you have good technical abilities, you can volunteer and help run some of our infrastructure.
I saw the list on your website, and a lot of mainstream media are donating to your site.
Well, they haven't donated any money, okay. But they do donate lawyers for our legal cases. And that's a very important contribution they have made. So that's 11 major US mainstream media organizations and the Society of Professional Journalists and other journalist unions in the United States, and ACLU and EFF and these other sort of civil rights groups have contributed to our legal cases. And that has been very valuable and important that they have done that. So I think the mainstream press here, the sort of quality aspect of the mainstream press, sees us as the free press vanguard. So the more we can publish, the more they can publish. If WikiLeaks.org is taken down today, maybe NYTimes.com will be taken down tomorrow. So we are both sort of the vanguard, the advance guard of press freedoms in the world, but we are also the canary in the coal mine. So if we fail in some way, then the next group to fail will be the mainstream press.
So are you being spied on by different governments or different entities or governments trying to shut down your website? I would imagine that there are many groups that have concerns about you.
Yeah, we have lots of litigation from banks because those people have lots of money and lots to hide. So there's been some serious cases. So in Swiss bank Julius Baer, the largest private Swiss bank, you can't open an account unless you've got over $1 million. It engaged in very serious litigation against us in San Francisco and lost. And that attempt to sue us, in fact, cancelled their US IPO, their sort of stock offering, cost them over $300 million. So quite a nice outcome. But many legal threats from Icelandic banks, from banks in Abu Dhabi, from UK banks. We actually haven't had too many from US, actually, even though we have released documents on them. I think they understand it's better to just keep quiet and not draw attention to those banking documents. For government interactions, we have had censorship we have ongoing censorship by China from the very beginning, from the moment of our launch. We have had some minor problems with Australia and Germany, but those have been rolled back. People saw that was the wrong thing to do. Even problems with Iran, and the Iranian government has rolled back and doesn't censor us anymore, which is good.
In 2007, you received military documents saying that U.S. troops were given authority to go into countries like Iran and Syria to hunt down Saddam Hussein's followers and alleged terrorists. What happened with that?
This is a very important document. We worked with New York Times reporter Eric Schmidt to expose this document and its context, and that was a leading article in the Times. The Iranian government saw that, and then the foreign minister at that time, I can't remember his name, held a press conference saying Iranian territory should not be entered by the United States. This is not acceptable to have rules that permit U.S. troops to enter into Iranian territory under their own decision. And it appears that those are no longer, in fact, we know, because we just released the 2008 version, that is no longer in the rules of engagement for U.S. troops. That is a significant advance. Many wars have been started from these border skirmishes where, for some maybe reasonable reason, troops from one country cross the border in pursuit of smugglers or terrorists into another country, and then the other country engages on them, and then there's a back and forth, and the situation escalates, and there's outrage in the various countries, and it makes the countries enemies, and a war starts. So I think it's not unreasonable to assume that there was about a 5% chance that document helped stop a war between the United States and Iran. Remember, this is in the context of 2007. This is when Bush's neocons were at their height in trying to foment some sort of conflict or hostility between Iran and the United States. Fortunately, that didn't happen, not just as a result of this document, but as a result of several people, good people within the U.S. administration, being unhappy about this and resigning or coming out in the press and saying that was what was going on and calling to stop it. Daniel Ellsberg, the famous whistleblower who leaked the Pentagon Papers here in the 1970s, he called tirelessly again and again for people to come out and leak information about the plans to have a war with Iran. Cy Hirsch published information saying that there were attempts to try and push for some kind of conflict with Iran. And so I think a combination of all these our efforts and these other groups' efforts ended up stopping that kind of conflict from going ahead, and that's a great thing.
I think it's interesting that you worked so closely with the New York Times. WikiLeaks also worked very closely with the Washington Post when WikiLeaks received a manual regarding Guantanamo telling secrets like detainees were being intimidated by dogs. What happened with that?
We got hold of the 2003 manual for Guantanamo Bay, which was authored by the then commander, General Miller. That is the same general who went to Abu Ghraib and set up Abu Ghraib in response to a request by Donald Rumsfeld saying, go to Abu Ghraib and gitmoise it, turn it into another Gitmo. Take the lessons you have learned in Guantanamo Bay and apply them to Abu Ghraib. And those abuses in Abu Ghraib occurred after that. So it's very interesting to sort of look at the progression of this abuse. And we see for the initial 2003 manual for Guantanamo that there was a policy of hiding people from the Red Cross for 1 month, a breach of the Geneva Conventions, not only just not allowing the Red Cross to see them, but hiding them, pretending that they weren't there at all, falsifying records. So it says in the manual for Guantanamo Bay that records should be falsified. Also that every initial prisoner is to be held in maximum penalty conditions when they first come in solitary confinement, and then as a sort of softening up process for interrogation. Now, when that information came out, the spokesperson for Guantanamo Bay said, oh, that was under Geoffrey Miller. That was under the previous general in 2003, and you know, even by the next year it had all changed. There was a new commander who came in. That statement stimulated another source to provide us with the 2004 manual. And then we compared every letter of difference between 2003 and 2004 and showed, no, it didn't get better, it got significantly worse. There was a show camp that was set up in 2004, Camp 4, which was a place that had guards just for their media and public relations skills. This is where you would take journalists and visiting foreign MPs to show them Guantanamo wasn't so bad after all. The language had changed to remove all references to, say, suicide and call this self-harm, and a number of other problems. We worked with the Center for Constitutional Rights, based here in New York, who provide many of the lawyers for the Guantanamo Bay detainees, to go over that and analyze and assess it and get it out.
I only have time for one more question, and it is, do you fear for your personal safety? Do you fear that anyone may be coming after you, fear for your life, fear that you may be jailed?
No. None of us act like fools. So there are certain countries where it can be dangerous to do things. So there may be problems with me going to China, as an example. But here in the West, it's in no one's career interest to do anything like that to us. I mean, the backlash would be so extraordinary that it would be sort of some kind of career suicide. So it's in no one individual's self-interest, from the CIA to the military to do anything like that. So it doesn't get done. So even if you might say, well, is it in the sort of CIA's institutional interest? Well, maybe, but it's not in any one individual's interest to do that, so it's not going to happen. Also, we have a lot of supporters, including within the US military. Those people leak us information about us. So when US counterintelligence started writing reports about us in 2008, those reports came to us and we released them. So I think it's quite hard for many governments to try and move against us in that way, because we have such extensive support in the mainstream media, amongst human rights activists, lawyers, and in intelligence organizations themselves. I think they have some respect for us, that we are in fact doing what they want to do. I mean, if you're a spy or intelligence agent, basically you're an investigative journalist who isn't able to publish. you're not able to tell the public all the things that you wanted to tell them. So we're a bit like that, except we can tell the public. So I think in some ways, amongst the good people in the intelligence community, there's a degree of camaraderie with what we do. I mean, they know that we're after the bad guys. I mean, we don't want to expose the good intelligence operations that are happening. We're after the bad guys as well, the abuses that occur. And I think individual intelligence officers in the United States and in many other countries understand that and are supportive.
Thank you so much for this very interesting and insightful conversation. We will be waiting for the video from Afghanistan. Are you planning on releasing that in Washington, D.C.? You don't know yet? Secretive as always. Well, thank you, Julian. This has been Julian Assange with WikiLeaks. I'm Rhonda Pence in New York City. Thank you so much for joining me on Face to Face.